The headlines this hour: thousands of Yemenis holding rallies in major cities to condemn U.S. support for a Saudi-led coalition's years-long war in their country. Tensions continue to simmer between Russia and NATO over Ukraine, as Moscow accuses the Western military alliance of arming Kiev with a massive amount of sophisticated weapons. And Austria begins a new national lockdown as protests against coronavirus restrictions spread across Europe amid surging infections. Some 7:30 p.m. in Iran's capital, Tehran. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Yemeni people have held massive rallies to condemn U.S. support for a Saudi-led coalition's years-long war on their country. The protests were held in several major cities, including Sada'a and the capital Sana'a. The demonstrators slammed Washington for being the main contributor to the deadly aggression against Yemen. They warned that the siege of Yemen would bring Riyadh and its allies nothing but greater loss. The protesters vowed to remain resilient and retaliate against any enmity toward their country. The nearly 7-year Saudi-led war in Yemen has killed tens of thousands, mostly civilians. The U.S. is among the main suppliers of weapons to Saudi Arabia. The kingdom is using those lethal weapons against its impoverished southern neighbor. Yemen's army has successfully hit several targets in Saudi Arabia, including Aramco refineries in Jeddah. The operation comes in retaliation to the kingdom's ongoing aggression against Yemen. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more.
Yemen's armed forces carried out another massive retaliatory attack against several targets in Saudi Arabia using 14 drones. The targets included Aramco refineries in Jeddah, as well as several military sites in Riyadh, Abha, Jizan, and Najran.
In response to the escalation of the Saudi-led aggression and its crimes and siege, our armed forces conducted the 8th operation codenamed Balance of Deterrence by bombing several military and vital targets of the Saudi enemy. The armed forces have proven their ability to carry out more offensive operations against the Saudi and Emirati enemy within the legitimate defense of our people and homeland.
Experts say this operation comes in response to Riyadh's recent escalation in Marib and the fresh air strikes that killed civilians, including children, in Hodeidah and other cities.
This large-scale operation came amid the ongoing aggression and in response to the recent Saudi escalation. Saudi-led coalition is trying to pressure our forces to stop their progress towards the city of Marib by targeting civilians, and this prompted the Yemeni army leadership to accelerate the implementation of major operations deep inside the kingdom.
Recently, the Saudi-led coalition has escalated its airstrikes across Yemen and killed more civilians, including children. However, Yemen's military has vowed to hit back at those killing Yemeni civilians.
The Yemeni army has given a stern warning to the Emirati regime, saying it is capable of expanding the range of its attacks to include targets deep inside Emirati territories. Yemeni say their army should continue its operations until the war is stopped. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iran has dismissed U.S. threats after Washington said that all options are on the table if the upcoming talks with the parties to the 2015 nuclear deal fail.
We have seen all the options at their disposal in a country like Afghanistan, and they have witnessed the outcomes as well. I think that not even Americans themselves believe in what they are saying when they say such things.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said that Iran's focus in the Vienna talks is the removal of what he called unilateral and tyrannical sanctions. Saeed Khatibzadeh said that Iran is serious in this endeavor and called on the other parties to attend the talks with the same level of commitment. He also expressed hope that the upcoming visit by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency to Iran is constructive. The spokesman said that Iran has always called on the agency to pursue technical cooperation and prevent the abuse of its name by some countries for their own political agendas. Principal correspondent in Vienna, Homolesky, says Tehran has repeatedly criticized the International Atomic Energy Agency for refusing to condemn attacks on its nuclear facilities which Iran blames on Israel.
Most recently, there was an attack on its Karaj facility, and what we know is that one of the IAEA cameras in that facility was destroyed as a result of that attack, which Iran has blamed on Israel and which Iran has called a terrorist attack. Iran has been criticizing the IAEA for refusing to condemn in many words these kinds of attacks on its nuclear facilities, saying that the fact that the IAEA, the US, and the Europeans remain silent on these kinds of attacks by Israel that are even endangering the safety and security of the IAEA's inspectors in Iran, and at the same time asking Iran to increase IAEA monitoring and to give more access to the agency is not acceptable, and also at the same time saying that the IAEA should not only condemn Israel but also question Israel about its own nuclear weapons program, instead of when we heard there in your news story politicizing the case of Iran's program.
One of the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are to engage in talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, on November 29. Tehran is now warning the U.S. to stop using threats and to focus on removing anti-Iran sanctions in a verifiable manner.
As time is ticking away for Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal to get around the table to talk, the world is curious to know what could come out. Iran says it will only focus on the removal of sanctions.
What is the center of focus in Vienna will be removing sanctions that have been imposed against Iran in a unilateral, extraterritorial, tyrannical, and illegal manner. The only thing that would help the U.S. is admitting that it's to blame for the current situation. It should remove the sanctions and give us a firm guarantee.
Officials say they have their own reasons for their stance. Iran has long been complaining that it is not receiving the economic benefits expected under the nuclear accord. Even during the tenure of former U.S. President Barack Obama, Iranian officials noted that the intense U.S. pressure is discouraging foreign partners from engaging in trade with Tehran. Obama's successor, Donald Trump, took this policy to the extremes when he unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the accord in 2018. Encouraged by hawkish U.S. politicians, the Israeli regime and several Arab rulers, he imposed rounds after rounds of tough sanctions on Iran in an attempt to make the JCPOA a thing of the past. The assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani further heightened tensions between the U.S. and Iran, and Washington's insistence on enforcing the sanctions that made life harder for millions of Iranians in need of drugs amid the coronavirus pandemic made matters even worse. Meanwhile, the European parties to the deal dragged their feet in compensating for the U.S. withdrawal. They even failed to properly launch a mechanism called INSTEX, which they called an alternative to promote commercial business with Iran, despite U.S. sanctions. All the while, Iran kept honoring all its nuclear commitments, as verified by the UN nuclear watchdog. But there was a limit to Tehran's patience. Around a year after the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA, and when Iran found the Europeans to be a hopeless case, it started to walk back on some nuclear obligations. Tehran says this is consistent with the JCPOA, which stipulates in its Articles 26 and 36 that parties can reduce their commitment in case others do the same. Now, Trump is gone, but his successor, Joe Biden, is in no rush to fix things. Almost a year into his presidency, Biden is yet to cancel any of the anti-Iran measures adopted by the Trump administration, and is effectively sticking to his so-called maximum pressure campaign by imposing even more sanctions. Iran says the U.S. must make up for its mistakes. Tehran says the ball is now in the court of Biden and his European counterparts to show they're ready to abandon Trump's legacy on Iran and chart a new path forward.
Tensions are heating up between Russia and the West over Ukraine. Moscow is now accusing NATO of supplying Kyiv with a significant amount of sophisticated weapons and helping the country build up its forces. The Kremlin says it is observing such, quote, provocative activities with great alarm. It also dismisses allegations that Moscow is poised to attack Ukraine, accusing U.S. media of being involved in a propaganda campaign. That after a U.S. media outlet reported that Russia has deployed over 92,000 troops around Ukraine's borders. It also cited a Ukrainian official as saying that Russia is preparing for an attack early next year. Moscow says the allegations could be aimed at diverting attention from Kiev's own plans to escalate tensions in eastern Ukraine. Russia also accuses the West of artificially whipping up tensions in the region. China and Lithuania are engaged in a spat over Taiwan. Beijing slams the Baltic state for allowing Taipei to open a so-called representative office in Vilnius, saying that the move was likely instigated by major powers. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman says the Lithuanian government has sacrificed the country's interests, damaged its diplomatic relationship with China with such a move. Zhao Lijian has also warned other countries against being coerced by certain powers and getting involved in what he calls unnecessary confrontation. Lijian has called on Lithuania to reverse his decision. Lijian said that China will take all the necessary measures to safeguard its national sovereignty, territorial integrity, and core interests. Tensions have been running high between China and Lithuania since Thursday. That is when Taipei said that it had formally opened a de facto embassy in the Baltic state. China reacted by downgrading its diplomatic relations with Lithuania to the level of charge d'affaires and said that it was prepared to end bilateral diplomatic ties if necessary. Beijing views Taiwan as part of its territory under the One China policy. China has already been at odds over the island with the U.S. and its allies. A new national lockdown is now in effect in Austria, as the Western European country is trying to tackle skyrocketing coronavirus infections. The lockdown will last at least 10 days, but officials have not ruled out the possibility of an extension to 20 days. During the lockdown, most gathering places like restaurants, theaters, and non-essential shops will be closed. Austrians are also not allowed to leave home except to go to work, shop for essentials, and exercise. The new curbs come as tens of thousands of people took to the streets on Saturday to protest against the measures, with some blaming the government for COVID-related inaction. The government, however, says the lockdown is only an answer to the surge in cases. The country has recently reported between 14 and 15,000 daily cases.
Coronavirus restrictions are returning to Europe as the governments struggle to tackle the resurgence of the pandemic. The measures have sparked protests in several European countries. Cities across the Netherlands saw fiery riots erupt for a second night, with angry mobs running amok in The Hague. Hooded protesters torched bicycles on Saturday night and threw stones and fireworks at police. Officers, some on horseback, responded by charging on the crowd and making arrests. But the rally in the capital Amsterdam remained largely peaceful amid a heavy police presence. During the first night of the unrest in the port city of Rotterdam, police opened fire on protesters, injuring a few and rounded up dozens. The Netherlands has imposed a three-week partial lockdown after registering a record spike in COVID cases. The government is also planning to ban unvaccinated people from entering public places, but the opponents argue that such restrictions are not the answer. Also in Austria, a 20-day nationwide lockdown and a plan to make jabs mandatory have brought tens of thousands to the streets of Vienna. Austria is the first European country to make vaccination a legal requirement, but the protesters believe the government is only restricting their freedom. Croatians, frustrated by COVID measures, marched through the capital Zagreb in their thousands to tell the government enough is enough. Refusing to wear protective masks, the protesters called for the government to scrap compulsory vaccinations for public sector workers.
I came to support all the people who oppose COVID passports because it's actually a measure that divides us into citizens and non-citizens, and it leads to great discrimination, even towards totalitarianism.
I think that our government is doing the same thing countries that collaborated with Nazi Germany did in the 1940s.
The COVID pass for civil servants also enraged thousands of Danes who came out in Copenhagen to call on the government to cancel the measure. The World Health Organization is warning that Europe is the only region in the world with surging deaths, and that the virus could kill 500,000 more people by February. 70 million infections, 1.6 million deaths, and still counting. For now, it seems that governments across Europe are facing the double dilemma of keeping the protests in check and bringing the fresh wave of infections under control.
The Indian capital, New Delhi, is battling to contain a severe air pollution that is soaring to deadly levels. City authorities have taken many steps to address the crisis, as the residents are gasping for fresh air. However, health experts are saying the issue needs a long-term solution. Our correspondent Munawwar Zaman has more in this report.
It's a day as usual for millions of residents across the bustling Indian capital, New Delhi, as winter looms, debates and awareness about pollution starts making news. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. With the arrival of the festival of Diwali and the farmers clearing fields for the next crop, it's the capital which has to pay heavy price. Over the last 2 weeks, New Delhi has been choking with a lethal layer of thick smog hovering over the residents who are now gasping for fresh air. For this labor working in the outskirts of Delhi, it's a day as usual. Since last week, the hospitals are witnessing rising numbers of admissions, as many are struggling with breathing issues. Health officials have advised people to stay indoors and avoid outdoor physical activities. New Delhi has taken some measures, such as work from home for government employees and ban on trucks entering the city till November 26. But many say there is a need for a long-term solution.
I think the government must take this issue serious, as it's the matter of health of the citizens. If we can't take steps now, our future generation will pay a heavy cost.
Considering the alarming situation, schools have also been shut till further notice. The country's top court directed the administration to take this issue on utmost priority and find a long-term solution. The air quality in New Delhi deteriorated after Diwali on November 4, shrouding the entire capital with toxic smog. Stubble burning by farmers in the neighboring state of Haryana and Uttar Pradesh, which surrounds the capital, is also blamed for the crisis. The story is the same every year. This morning, the air quality has improved due to change in wind speed. The administration has also taken a string of measures to tackle the crisis. Experts, however, say more strategies are needed to solve the pollution crisis in the Indian capital. Munawwar Zaman, New Delhi.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Oh my God. these morning scenes are very tragic. I really can't see people crying and moaning. Before I forget, let me tell you one thing. We are going to visit a historical cemetery today. We are going to visit Sefid Shah Cemetery. Sefid Shah Cemetery, which is known as White Cemetery, is located in Behshahr County, Yanesar Division, Sefid Shah Village in Mazandaran Province. This cemetery dates back to 1,200 years ago. Sefid Shah Cemetery was registered in Iran's National Monuments List in 2003. Local people of this region believe that if they bury the dead body of their loved ones in this cemetery, the dead body won't get decomposed after the passage of time. However, it's not a myth, and there are signs of facts and evidence regarding this belief. According to the researchers on this cemetery, there is a considerable amount of lime in the soil, which causes the bodies buried there not to be affected by decomposition. Sefid Shah Cemetery has both upright and coffer-shaped headstones. The carvings on the upright headstones are in three types: Eslimi, geometrical, and symbolic. On top of a hill in the cemetery, there are some coffer-shaped headstones, which the oldest of them dates back to 896 AH. I am now in Sefid Shah Cemetery. This cemetery is not crowded today and at this time of the day. Its atmosphere is so mysterious that you might imagine that you have traveled to the past. A cool breeze is blowing, and the sound of the breeze has made an amazing atmosphere. A special feature of the Sefid Shah Cemetery is its upright headstones in the historic part of the cemetery. For your information, these types of headstones are very rare in Iran. On these headstones, the profession and age of the dead person is written. Also, beautiful designs have been carved on many of these headstones. The interesting point about this cemetery is that the gender of dead people are represented in a very special way. For example, if you see a two-edged comb on the headstone, it means that this grave belongs to a man. And if you see a one-edged comb on the headstone, it means that the grave belongs to a woman. And in this part of the cemetery, the graves are so close to each other that makes walking hard. Oh, something interesting. I am now standing in a part of the cemetery where almost all the graves are old. However, there is a new grave among them. It's a black upright headstone. Looks like a leaf. And on the leaf, there is the picture of an old woman wearing a white scarf with some gray hair showing up in one edge of the scarf. She looks like my deceased aunt. And nothing is written on this headstone. In the middle of the stone, something like a house is carved with a circle inside. And there are bizarre shapes on the edges of the headstone. Well, I don't know what exactly they are. Maybe something like dummies, which are carved very amateurishly. And here, there is a huge tree. I'd better get seated beneath its shadow. The silence in this old cemetery is pregnant with meaning. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I want to look at the topic of marriage. What is the position of the Quran and Islam on the sacred reunion of marriage and family relationships? The sad reality, brothers and sisters, is this, that when it comes to marriage, you know, there is no license you have to get. You know, when you go to, if you want to become a pharmacist, or you want to become an engineer, or you want to even do, let's say, you want to become a graphic designer or a professional photographer, or a whatever you want to do in life, you need to go to school. You go through elementary, junior high, high school, university. You go and educate, and you get a piece of paper from a university, a degree, that says now you are qualified to do a particular job. To drive a car. Our young boys and girls know that you need to take driving school, or you advise to do driving school. You will do in-class training. You'll write an exam, you'll have in-car training, and then you'll go and do your exam at the motor vehicles department. All of this just to be able to drive a car. But I would ask all of us tonight to think about this, that when was the last time that you heard that to get married, that you needed to take a course? In order for you to be allowed to have children, you needed to take a course on how to be a good mother or father. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen in our community. There are some Shia communities, I would say, that I have seen where the scholar who runs the community will tell his congregation that if you want to get married in my masjid and you want me to be there to officiate your marriage ceremony, you need to take a particular course in marriage that I offer in my center. But the sad reality is that most of our communities do not have that system. We're not equipped. We haven't created the manual. There are very few books in English and our other languages, I would say, that teach a man and a woman what they need to know going into marriage. And so we jump into it blindly, thinking that I watched enough television to know how to be a good wife. I've watched enough YouTube shows or Netflix to know how to be a good husband or father, or a good mother-in-law or a good father-in-law. But the sad reality is, brothers and sisters, that until we actually codify and ensure that these teachings of the Quran and Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam, unless we ensure that they are written and given to our next generation and taught to them, we're going to continue to face challenges, and they will only get larger and larger because of the system and the society that we are living in today. Not only in Canada, I'm sure if you look at the Muslim world, the Middle East, they are also, I'm sure, grappling with this same situation. So there's three questions I want to go through tonight, three points in this lecture for tonight. One is the institution of marriage. Where and when did this start? Number two is, what is the Quranic view on marriage? And what are the two prime governing factors that Allah has implemented or instructed for a man and a woman and a family to lead a successful Islamic life? And number three, if we have the time, is what to look for in a spouse and how to find that potential spouse within our lives. The first question is, how does this institution of marriage begin? Well, as I mentioned in the beginning, that when Allah created the first human being, Prophet Adam alayhi salam, he then created his mate. As Allah says in the Quran, even in Surah An-Nisa, where Allah says that He created the man and then He created the partner. Allah says right at the beginning of Surah An-Nisa that Allah says He created the spouse and He created from that individual the spouse. Now, He doesn't say man from woman or woman from man or what the order was, but we know that Allah created Adam and He created Hawa alayhim assalam. The Quran doesn't tell us, so when we go to the hadith, we have a beautiful tradition that the late Shaykh As-Saduq, rahmatullah alayh, quotes both in his book, Man La Yahadhurul Faqih, in volume 3 in the bab, in the section of nikah, of marriage, and also in Ilul al-Shara'i. And basically, the summary of the story is that Allah created Adam, and he existed for a period of time, and then Allah put him to sleep, or he fell asleep. And in that time period where he was asleep, we're told that Hawa alayhi salam was created. Hawa is created. Adam wakes up from the sleep and he sees this other person. He sees this individual whom obviously he didn't know who this was. He was just created, and a certain amount of time, however much it was or it wasn't, had elapsed. He sees another person and he reaches out to touch her. And at this point, the angels intervene and they say that, oh Adam, that this individual that you see, who has been created for you to be to be in a relationship with you, you are not allowed to physically touch her until a process is carried out. And so Adam asks the angels, what is this process? And the angels go to mention that this is what today you and I know as marriage. So Adam says, okay, well, you know, let's go ahead. Let's get this marriage over with. Let's get things done. And the angels say, well, you know what? There's a process. You have to ask her wali, her guardian, for permission. You have to present her with a mahar, a gift. And then you can enter into marriage with this individual. And so to make this long story short, he asked other questions to the angels. They responded He asked Allah for the permission. Permission was granted. Obviously, Hawa alayha salam herself would have had to have give permission. The mahar, the gift which was required, according to the hadith that Shaykh As-Saduq quotes, are two things. One was that Adam would teach her the religion, and the salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. And then the marriage goes, and Adam and Eve, in some otherworldly realm, wherever they existed, they were married in the presence of Allah. And then obviously, as the Quran talks about, that they were in the garden, which was a garden of earth. They ate from a tree that they were required not to eat from, not that it was a sin. And they ended up coming down in terms of their status. They were living on earth, that the same earth that you and I live on. They had children, they had sons, they had a family. And obviously from that first union that happened, however many years ago it would have happened, we are here today. This is the first marriage that happened in the humanity, in the history of humanity. And obviously after that, every other marriage has taken place in a natural way between a man and a woman. A contract is agreed upon, a gift is given by the man to the woman, and they live. But keep in mind, brothers and sisters, just as those who are married got married at one point, and those who are in the future to get married, that this marriage that happened at the time of Adam and happens up until today is not just an agreement by a man and a woman to live together. No, we have to realize that as with every action in our lives, that a marriage is a contract between the man, the woman, and Allah. That the man will treat the woman as Allah wants him to treat her. That the woman will treat her husband in the way that Allah expects a woman to treat her husband. A marriage is not just like a business deal that you sign a contract. It is a contract, yes, in a way, but it is between three people: Allah, the man, and the woman. Because in Islam, as we know, that Islam governs all of the actions in our lives, and that when a man and a woman decide to marry one another, that they do so recognizing the fact that they will live according to the rules of Islam, that they will do their best to follow the sunnah of Rasulullah. How did the Prophet treat his wives? How did the wives of the Prophet treat Rasulullah? Right? We don't have time to go into it, but if you have time, read how the Prophet and Khadija alayha salam, Umm al-Mu'mineen, the first and the most beloved wife of the Prophet, how she lived with the Prophet, how she helped the Prophet, how she respected the Prophet. And look at how the Prophet treated Khadija alayha salam. It was no less love than she showed him. The respect he showed her was as much, if not more, than what Khadija alayha salam reciprocated with.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Matin.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Some police departments across the United States have embraced the corrupting and unjust practice of raising revenue from their municipalities by pushing police officers to write as many traffic tickets as possible. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times, and it has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper. The article is titled, Train the Police to Keep the Peace, Not Turn a Profit. Some police departments across the country have embraced the corrupting and unjust practice of raising revenue for their municipalities by pushing police officers to write as many traffic tickets as possible. Policing for profit encourages unfair enforcement of the law. It also increases the likelihood that motorists stopped for infractions largely unrelated to public safety will be injured or even killed during encounters with police officers who are trained to view traffic stops as moments of mortal peril. The situation cries out for departments to change how police officers are trained. Ultimately, these departments need to stand down from practices that bring many more people than necessary into contact with the law under circumstances that too often lead to what one district attorney refers to as anticipatory killings by police officers. The New York Times lays out these and other issues in an alarming investigation of the culture that too often transforms traffic stops for common violations into unnecessary beatings, car chases, and shootings. The New York Times investigation found that over the past 5 years, police officers have killed more than 400 drivers who were not brandishing guns or knives or who were not being pursued for dangerous crimes. Many of these motorists ended up dead in traffic stops that began with standard violations like having broken taillights or running a red light. Over and over again, prosecutors convinced the courts that the killings were legally justified because the police officers felt their lives were endangered. Only five police officers were convicted of crimes in connection with these deaths, but local governments ended up paying at least $125 million to settle about 40 wrongful death lawsuits and other claims. The Times investigation found in a number of encounters that police officers often seemed to exaggerate the threat to their lives. Worse still, officers commonly manufactured dangerous situations by stationing themselves in front of fleeing cars or reaching inside of vehicles. They then fired their guns in what they later described as self-defense. African-American motorists were overrepresented among those killed. A criminologist told the New York Times that the act of exaggerating the danger of stops compounded racial bias. Police think vehicle stops are dangerous and black people are dangerous, and the combination is volatile, he said. Police officers are sometimes killed during traffic stops, but statistically speaking, the odds of that actually happening are very low. Traffic stops are far and away the most common point of contact between people and the law. Given that there are tens of millions of such stops each year, studies have found that a police officer's chances of being killed during one are less than 1 in 3.6 million. Nevertheless, police academies tend to show trainees gory videos and worst-case scenarios, while depicting the traffic stop as the most dangerous encounter a police officer can engage in. And one police official told the New York Times, "All you've heard are horror stories about what could happen. It is very difficult to try to train that out of somebody. A culture of gross exaggeration creates an atmosphere in which outrageous police conduct leading up to a civilian death is judged acceptable." For example, the New York Times investigation found that more than three-quarters of the unarmed motorists who died were killed while attempting to flee. Dashboard and body camera footage showed police officers shooting at cars driving away or threatening deadly force in their worst words to motorists, or surrounding sleeping drivers with a ring of gun barrels, then shooting them when startled awake they tried to take off. The federal government worsens this problem by spending more than $600 million a year to subsidize the writing of tickets. At least 20 states have responded to this policy by evaluating police officers based on how many traffic stops they make per hour. Communities that are dependent on traffic ticket revenue sometimes maintain larger police departments than are really necessary, only for the purpose of raking in money. The New York Times investigation found more than 730 communities across the United States that rely on fees and fines for at least 10% of their revenues. The town of Henderson, Louisiana, with a population of about 2,000, got nearly 90% of its general revenue from fines and fees in 2019. The community of Oliver, Georgia, home to about 380 people, gets more than half of its budget from fines and fees. A state investigation found that last year, the town's police force had written more than $40,000 worth of tickets outside its legal jurisdiction. Departments that trawl poor communities in particular for ticket revenue, and whose police officers sometimes manufacture infractions, undermine trust in the law. Policing for profit also subjects motorists to unfair scrutiny and potentially dangerous encounters with police officers during traffic stops. States and municipalities need to move away from this practice. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The appointment of an imam and leader.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
If you look at the Qur'an, there are at least two verses in which prophets are described as imams. One of them is, "And we made them imams, guiding men by our command. And we sent them inspiration to do good deeds, to establish regular prayers." The Holy Qur'an, Surah 21, verse 73. Another verse that mentions God appointing imams is, "And we appointed from among them imams, giving guidance under our command." The Holy Qur'an, Surah 32, verse 24. This means that a prophet is an imam, leader and commander in society. That is why Imam Sadiq alayhi salam stood up among the crowd gathered in Mina and shouted, "O people, the Messenger of God was indeed an imam." In order for people to understand what the correct religious status of the Holy Prophet was, he stood up among the crowd and shouted, "O people, the Messenger of God was indeed an imam." Well, this is one issue.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Throughout the world of Islam, religious intellectuals, religious scholars, writers, researchers, and university professors have the duty to explain this, because the enemy heavily invests in promoting and the opposite viewpoint. The heavy responsibility of intellectuals and scholars for explaining the scope of religion's activity. Of course, our task in Iran is even heavier in this regard. The reason for this is that there are more possibilities here for us to work on this. The country's officials, especially officials in cultural fields and people who have important podiums available to them in some areas of society, should explain this. Inside the country, it is not the case that now that an Islamic system has been established in the Islamic Republic, we do not need to explain this issue. No. Right now, in our country, some falsehoods are being promoted in this regard, and certain things are being said, but we are active in this field. Well, this is a topic that is related to the world of Islam.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.